welcome to another episode of Write Now, a podcast on the craft and business of writing, presented to you by Broadleaf Writers Association based in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Dawn Major, a board member with Broadleaf, and I am thrilled to welcome Janice Ray. Just a little background on Janice. She is a nature writer, naturalist, and teacher with a passion for place. You can say that again. She wrote the classic environmental memoir, Ecology of Your Cracker Childhood. Her latest book is A Guide to a Sense of Place, Journey in Place, a Field Guide to Belonging. She lives on a historic farm in the coastal plains of southern Georgia, where she writes the nature Substack, Trackless Wild. So to start, I thought when I reached out to you, because I've known you because I met you at the MFA program, you're a keynote speaker, and I took your workshop there. And then I took another online course with you. I looked back, it was 2022. So I'm reaching out to you about this now. And I thought, okay, should I even mention that I'm writing speculative memoir? I mean, because I've mentioned it to other authors, and I get this look comes across their face, and I'm like, oh, they're going to cringe because it's so oxymoronic. And so I have to get your take on it. Like, do you think it's taking away from the point of memoir, or do you think it's okay to experiment with the genre?
No, I'm kind of horrified that you even would pause before, you know, mention.
Oh, I thought you were saying you're horrified that I'm doing.
No, not horrified at all. I think creativity knows no bounds. What you're doing and others expands the limit of possibilities, really, for all of us. The possibilities of what a book can do, and the possibilities in a bigger sense of creativity itself. And that's a wonderful thing, you know. It's wonderful for human potential. So I love it.
Well, good. I got your stamp of approval. And I'm like, I have mentioned to other people, I went in this month, she's like, what? That doesn't make any sense. But hopefully when I get it published, it will make a lot more sense.
So Dawn, that's really my bigger question is, if you don't take mind taking just a minute to answer, and that is, how are you doing it? And so when you mean speculative, are you meaning supernatural? Are you meaning fantasy? Like where are
so
you?
I'm very autobiographical anyway, so I always write about real settings. And most of my characters are inspired by real people, but I change names. Or they're like pieces, you know. I never really believe fiction writers when they say they don't borrow from their life. I mean, maybe there's some things where I kind of create it from beginning to end, but there's always some piece of it that's real. So with the Dandy Chronicles, it's about me navigating Los Angeles in the 70s. And I use real names, my family's name, my sisters and my mom and my dad. And there's real scenarios, real settings, real people, but the family's slowly turning into demons. So, which might be true, actually. And that's kind of how I dealt with some trauma, is like, because I will write a piece in realism and then I'll turn it around. I'll use that same piece and I'll write speculative. So I flip flop.
So why wouldn't you just write this as fiction? I mean, why wouldn't you just call it fiction since?
I could call it that. I read some, I can't remember the person who was writing speculative memoir, but I feel like there's a percentage of it that's so real that I don't want to explain that part of it. You know, like, I don't want to be like, well, this was really inspired by this. And so I may just call it fiction when I end up with at the end of it, just because I don't know what a publisher is going to think about me saying this is speculative memoir. Are they going to get it either? But I like the idea of I like to experiment. And I thought this might be kind of something cool to do, because I don't like writing straight up like real things. Sometimes they're just too hard to write, you know? Yeah. So it's easy to encapsulate that. Well, let's go into,
let me say, before we
oh,
do,
go ahead.
Let me just say one more thing. And that is, you know, life, I have known some stories in real life, so strange. I mean, so otherworldly that they themselves seem speculative, you know? And so I think that whatever tool or technique that we can use to tell the story that needs to be told is open to us.
Well, I mean, that's why, like when I said, I switch back and forth between, I think that's a, I've told people this before, especially I'm in the Horror Writers Association, especially people who write in speculative. I've told them, you can flip-flop. You can get a lot more out of your work if it's possible to do that. If it doesn't fit, it doesn't fit. But I have written, there's a piece called The Easter Dress, and I got that published, like the realistic. It's still fiction, but very inspired by my life. And I had that published this past year. It got nominated for Pushcart, so maybe I'll win. I doubt it though. And then I turn around and I wrote it, in speculative, and it was so brutal writing that, like in realism. It was just, I'm like, I just felt drained, but it was fun switching it over to speculative. So I think that's just sort of my thing. I go back and forth. But on this, go ahead. Did you have something else to say? I don't want to interrupt you.
Just congratulations on the Pushcart nomination.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, oh my God. I mean, yeah, it's really competitive. I thought I'll get it. But anyway, it's nice. I know you won one, so didn't you?
I did. It's yeah, I did. I yeah. Pushcart is interesting because you have to be nominated by somebody who's won,
Yeah.
and so any yeah, it's just some pride. Like you can work behind the scenes on almost anything. I know that you didn't do this, but it I don't know. It I think I better not say anything more.
Okay, I got the feeling that you're monitoring what you're saying, so we'll skip to the next question about the differences between memoir and autobiography. And do you think creative fiction gives you more liberty with the truth?
I don't think so. I think the truth is the truth. And I think if you're writing something that's called memoir, then probably you should say, you should, it should be obvious either. I mean, speculative fiction, it would be so obvious because, nobody would ever think that your grandfather is going to come, land back on Earth from death in a spaceship, So that's going to be pretty obvious. But I think what it does give you leeway with is the craft itself. So creative nonfiction, I don't think you mess around with the truth so much, and I don't think the truth is important. I think we'll talk more about truth, but I think the power that it gives you is in the crafting itself.
Well, when I took your course back when, whatever it was, online course, I wonder, I can't remember if it was on memoir or what it was, probably, or essay writing. I can't remember which one, but it was all kind of connected anyway. And you talk a lot about journaling, and I tell you what, first question I have to ask you is, when you're journaling, are you Is there this intent behind it that you think, okay, this is going to make something and turn into something that I'm going to publish? Or do you keep some of those little pieces just for yourself?
My journal is both, Dawn. It's an awesome question, and I think that a lot can be taught from this moment. And let me just say why. So, just journaling for yourself is so important. Just processing your life, just thinking about what was working for me in 2025, and what is not going to work for me anymore, and what is 2026 going to look like, and how what did I really think about that last visitor, and all that. Even if at the end of the journal you burn the whole thing, it's very, very helpful for strategizing your life, for staying on track, for checking in with yourself, for staying on a path, not letting some other thing swing you off your path. But I read Robert Olin Butler and Janet Burroway's book called The Zone. I think that's what it's called. No, from where it's called From Where We, whatever it's called. It's Robert Olin Butler's lectures from Florida State University. And Janet, who also was a professor there, edited them. They worked together on this, but it was apparently lectures that he had given. And he says in that book, he says most journals are, what's his word? Most journals are nonsense. Most are repositories of great swatches of abstraction and generalization and all that stuff. Most journals, I think he said, are counterproductive. He said, but there's a certain kind of journal that you could do. And what he says is, on it, if you were sitting down to write today, think of an event from the past few days that triggered a strong emotion in you and render
Oh
that,
man, it
yeah,
just came to
render that event moment to moment through the senses. So, Don, this is what you're training yourself. Scene writing is exactly what this, I think over the course of the last 30 years, we in general have become very lazy writers in the US. We want to write, and Substack, I do it on Substack myself. We want to write our thoughts. We don't take the time to craft scenes that make people want to read them, that bring the reader and sit them in the middle of this meadow, and this thing unfolds in the meadow that's unbelievable, right? We don't take the time. We just want to download our opinions, our thoughts, our feelings.
Oh God, the rants I have read.
Yeah. So this is how I teach. Like in every course is I first teach people how to recognize a scene. I have had writers or wannabe writers take an entire 12-week course from me, get to the end and not really be able to recognize what a scene is. And it's shocking. So therefore, let me go back to my journals. This morning, my journal writing, I write in the
And
morning.
it's daily. You do it every day, right?
Not every day, but almost every day. If I had the time, I would do it every day. But I have a brand new baby.
I know.
Yeah, my husband and I switch
Congratulations.
her off back and forth every 3 hours. I have her, and so we also switch off overnight. So last night she slept with her papa. Tonight she sleeps with me, and the way it works out is if she's, it's just there is no regular routine. My days
You
are
just
all.
squeeze it in.
That's exactly right. I squeeze it in. So most days I'm squeezing in just like getting off my emotional overburden. However, if I'm really working in my journal or really just working, I'm thinking of some event that I don't want to forget and I render it in scene in my journal, including as much crafting as possible.
As much as you can get out there, and then you go back.
Yep. And so, yeah, that's exactly right. Somewhere in the questions you mentioned this and so that is my advice. Like, so if you don't have that, you're going to need to be recreating these things from the past by old artifacts, old documents, photographs,
Yeah,
asking
that's kind of
people.
what I'm doing with this. Of course,
Yeah.
and plus, like, do I really remember? Because this is following the Odyssey of Dan. Danny's my family nickname that they call me. And so this is following from about the age of 4. I don't remember everything from the age of 4. But what you're talking about seeing that there are these moments, and for whatever reason, when you're a child, this particular something will just stick with you. And there's other things that seem more significant, but this one silly whatever, something sticks with you. So I try to go down that road a little bit. And then of course I'm like going in images, photos like you mentioned.
And also interviews with other people. You know, I don't know if you're doing that or not, if you trust, if you have credible narrators or not. But when I was writing ecology, I would call up members of my family with long lists of questions. And it was really shocking to me how my sister remembered things differently than I remembered. But also from the, I wrote scenes that happened before I was born. And I've been in talks where people said how my parents eloped and they went and knocked on the door of the preacher of the preacher's house, the preacher friend of my grandfather, so my mother's father. And he said, like, I'm not marrying you two in the church. But they said, well, if you don't marry us, somebody will. And so he walked them under the eaves of the church outside, and you read them, the marriage bands. I rendered that in scene. It's easy. My parents are characters. I know I can describe them easily because I've seen photographs from, the time when they were 18 and 20. They've told me what they said, what the preacher said back, what they said back. And then I have been to the church where they married. I know that under the eave, the rain hits rain rocks, these little, we down here, we have these little pebbles of ferrous oxide. So the rain will hit the rain rocks and you'll have this, little tiny line of pebbles under the eaves of a church.
You've been to the ch that church is still there. Is that what you were saying? The church is still okay.
So it's easy for me to recreate that in scene. So why do that? Because we as humans think in scenes. It's very important. It's why we love movies. Movies are scene after scene after scene. If you have somebody philosophizing, then all you can really have is a voice in the background, talking.
Talking head.
You can have an invisible or visible talking head, and that's pretty much the amount of abstraction you can have in a film. Otherwise, it's scene. And it works well because we think in scenes. As a 4-year-old, you're replaying this one very potent scene that happened.
Visually, mostly just visually. Now, but then it's like, how do you tap into those other senses from so long ago when you're not. But it's interesting. Sometimes if I smell, a certain smell, this one, a doctor's office, it smells just like my Nana's dining room. And I love it. I just love going in there and just, so it's like trying to remember what things even smell like. But most of it's for me, and I think most writers depend on visual imagery more than they should.
Somewhere I knew the percentage. It's way more that we rely on visual senses.
Do you think it's gotten worse with social media because you have to have these images that you're kind of scrolling through all the time?
A whole bunch of stuff has gotten worse with social media, but I don't know with that. But Dawn, let me say this. I have very avant-garde views about everything. So I think, we have the five main senses that you and I are talking about, but I think we have the sixth sense of of gut instinct, of intuition, that you happen to look at the clock. Like, why is it that you look at the clock and it's 5:55 or 3:33?
It's always like when you look at it, it's the same time. It is like it's always my birthday. It's always
Yeah.
telling me,
Like, how does that
thank
happen?
you, thank you. I thought I was the only one who
Well,
this happened to.
a scientist would say, well, you look at it and it's 1:25 and you just think nothing of it. I'm like, no, that's not what happens to me. I never look at the clock and then I glance, something says, look at the clock. I glance there and it's 2:22.
Is
Like,
that your number 222? Is
2:22 is my number. And every time I see it, I say my mantra. Like if I look at the clock, I just looked at the clock
I
and it,
need a mantra for this.
yeah.
It is 622. Okay, that was 622. What's your mantra? I'm deviating, but I'm
So
curious.
this mantra comes from The Big Leap by Gay Hendricks, and it's very simple. It's just I expand in love, creativity, and abundance as I inspire others around me to do the same. So all it really is saying is there's limitless potential. If you remove the blocks that mainly were put on you by your family before you could control them, before you could turn off certain voices, you're not pretty enough. You'll never be that. You'll never do this.
That innocent child kind of thing.
Yeah, you couldn't, all that stuff got laid into the fiber of your development before you were able to negate it in your mind. Now you can just like,
Now you go, no way, right.
exactly. And so what a mantra does is helps it just those inner, Gay Hendricks calls them glass ceilings, like the
I'm
inner
writing this
glass
down so I don't
ceiling. It
forget.
helps you just break through those inner glass ceilings. So it's I like to add words to it, but it's I ex his is I expand in love, creativity, and abundance.
That's so
Imagine
positive.
that.
It's lovely.
Imagine a limitless expansion of love, creativity, and
And you're
abundance.
manifesting it in a way too.
Oh, totally.
Totally.
It
Yeah.
always works. The one that I, so when I'm doing yoga, the one I always start out with, I do my yoga and then I get to the point where I'm going to meditate for a few minutes. It's my fear is that I'm not going to have enough time. And then my little baby came along and my time is like cut in a third. My
Oh,
work
yeah.
time is in a third. So my mantra there negates the scarcity of time. And it's just that what it says is it's basically like I am the source of time itself. I swim in vast oceans of time. I have all the time I need. And that's basically what a mantra is. Whatever is happening inside your head that you feel limits your ability to be great, then you just say the negative of that.
I have got to really think about that. I mean, I know there's a lot of stuff like that, but I got to think about that.
I look around, I work with a lot of writers in these courses. Today I had an hour long. I don't charge for coaching sessions, but this person had, no, I think she had bought, yeah, she'd been in one of my classes and I'd promised to meet with them for an hour each. And I never had met with her, but I met with her today. It's just like listening to people, you just hear their inner voices. They're afraid. They got spanked for speaking out when they were little, and they're afraid of writing this memoir and putting this stuff out there. They're, it's, I've had writers who would prefer to stay in the safe zone than I've had writers start Substacks or start blogs or start book proposals and be, like so determined, and then the fear of it all is just too much.
There is a lot of fear. Yeah. I mean, I can't remember how many were in my course, in my MFA program. It was a small class, maybe seven, but I don't think any of them are really writing anymore, which makes me so sad. We used to have workshop online workshops together because we want to continue that. Our family of workshopping, and then that lasted about a year and a half, and it trailed off, which makes me sad because they're such great writers. And I mean, maybe they'll go back to it. I hope they do. But on the subject of writing and on writing, I had mentioned about Stephen King because I don't know that many. We have Norton, we have Burroughs. That's different because those are instructional manuals where there's instances of like a something from a. Something about dialogue, and there's a passage from like some novel or short story or whatever. But what I really loved about yours is you really talking about seeing. If I was to listen, like I'm listening to it right now, and I also just downloaded it on Kindle, but I do need the physical copy. I like the idea of having all. You said something about meeting with this writer and hearing her voice. And so I love that you narrated it because I could hear your voice there. And it is really a magical book. It just like you really dive into the magic, and I mean like literally magic of writing, which I appreciate. But I don't think I could have ever listened to that like something if it was Norton, it wouldn't be the same. So why was
So,
it important to you to use memoir when you're writing really a book on writing? Rather than stick to the
yeah. So, so many writers like Eudora Welty, like so many writers have written their credos. And in fact, Milkweed Editions for a long time was putting out this credo series where nature writers would do this little kind of, novella length. Like a long essay that's their credo. And Kittredge has one called Taking William Kittredge, who was my major professor.
I know you always talk about him. He had an impact on you, like
Very
massive
much so.
impact. Yeah.
Massive. So his credo, his book in that series is called Taking Care: Thoughts on Storytelling and Belief. I love hearing the philosophies of writers, but But Dawn, what really happened for me is that when I Kittredge taught me this way of writing an essay that puts an uneven number of scenes together. I explain it in Craft and Current. I don't
Yeah.
think we're there yet.
No, I gotta say something funny after you're done with this.
All right.
Okay.
So, I'm sitting in this creative nonfiction workshop. I've never written an essay. I don't know how to write an essay. And he lays out this schema that he came up with. And it was just like, oh my God, I could have read a million books and not realized this is how it works. Like, not really even understood, like, not understood the narrative arc. And so I also, like, if I say to you, you need to really work hard on balance and syntax. Like, that's just like, what the heck do I mean by balancing syntax? So I think both are equally important. You're asking about, the real technical, practical craft of writing that is in the book and filled with the memoir philosophy, Why I Write Credo, part of the book. I think they're both equally important. I think you can kill yourself by not understanding craft, not understanding technique, not understanding what balancing syntax is. And you can also kill yourself not understanding the philosophy of what is behind why you write. And so just to put that in a, like just to hang that on the wall, writing is magic. It's a transformative
I
process.
agree.
It changes the writer and it changes the reader. It's meant to change the reader. It's meant to be alchemy. And so when we treat it as if it's not alchemy, it's just like this, stuff we spit out, it's ruinous, because it's frickin' magic.
But there's it is, and there's this part, I think it's chapter 13, where you talk about the percentage, because you really kind of break it down mathematically. You
Yeah.
know, this percentage has to be such and such and this. And you go, okay, this percentage, bullshit, bullshit. This is the funny thing, bullshit. And I was like, oh, this is so funny. I wonder how many times you said bullshit, bullshit, bullshit in that chapter. I just absolutely love that. But I do
So
feel with it being as a memoir, it takes, what it does is it takes me as a writer and puts me in your little writerly space, kind of imagining myself in that spot where you were, where you're talking about scene. You know, now I can put myself in that space when you were like your beginning stages of writing and what your experiences with writing, and then what, you know, and taking your knowledge and then putting that to in this in Crafting Current. And I want to throw this out because no, we have at least 10 minutes. Like, I have so many more questions. This could be like an hour-long segment, really. One thing I want to mention is I don't have the workbook, but I saw that. Did you publish a workbook like after? Okay, you didn't publish it the same. Did you publish it at the same time? I didn't realize that, but I did see when I was looking on your website that you offer a bundle, and I think that is. I want people to know who are listening to this because there's a lot of educators that are Broadleaf members, and that'd be a great thing to have, as you know, if you're teaching a course in creative writing. I wish I'd had it. I mean, I did have your workshop. That was kind of right before I graduated, but it's really good. I did gotta ask you this question because I was to another book that I'm reading. You know, I was gonna mention I was doing we're doing renovations, so all my books are in boxes right now. So all year I was like, oh my God, I gotta get ready for this interview, and all my Janice Ray books are somewhere else. So I'm like, well, this is an excuse to buy another one. So I bought Wild Card Quilt. And about you going to your grandma's home, returning home, and renovating it. And I mean, it's just a great story. And I gotta say, you need your own HGTV series. Like, I would watch you. I would so watch you. This is great. But I wanted to read this line that I found on page 33 because I think I'm pretty sure that I'm gonna, that you, anyway, let me just read this. So on three, it goes, like this. What is it in us that wants to return to the dream of our childhood? What is it in us that keeps coming back to that potent place? Which I think is very true. And I thought, I didn't know if you said this to me or someone else, where that, and I like to ask authors about this. about a homeland. Do you think that writing is a way of finding your spiritual homeland, or just a whole, I don't know, why is it the authors are seeking that? If you agree with that statement that they're seeking a spiritual homeland.
So I don't know. Yeah. The question is so esoteric, and
I'm
I
sorry.
just don't know. But I think it's not just writers. I think that we are deeply place-based people, but that our society, especially, industrialism and capitalism, has asked us to give up places, to travel across the country for
A job.
a job, a
That's what happened to
university.
us. That's what happened to my dad.
Yeah. Or, go to school. You go to school up in Maine, go to India for a internship. We're just asked to give up our places. And yet we humans evolved with place. Even hunter-gatherers who were migrating were migrating through really a finite kind of number of places, really. And we have a deep, deep connection to place, to understanding where we are. Let me also say what we writers are doing is really kind of furthering a culture, furthering human culture. Culture is a set of stories that we tell ourselves, usually about life in a place. And that's what we're doing as writers in the modern world right now. We're trying to understand the world. Yesterday, last night, I wrote a piece on, I have a Substack for writers called Spiral Bound. And I wrote a piece about, I feel the earth shaking, really, truly. I feel this metaphorical earth shaking because books are becoming less and less important in our world, in our lives. And yet we're measuring, so we're writing these stories, but everything that we're producing is being measured with metrics that are beyond our control. And the metrics are how much money is it on the bestseller list? How many followers? How many likes? How many comments? Right?
That's the stuff that gets to me. That's where I need to work on my mantra, because I don't feel like I'm doing enough. It's like I'm comparing myself. So you just helped me figure that out, actually, because
The question is sort of like what metrics are the dominant voices measuring, and what metrics do you really need to be measuring? And the alternate metrics could include, how much you resonate with readers, how many letters you get back, how good the writing is for your own soul. There are lots and lots of other ways, but we live in a time where the things that books meant to us as children, you and I, Dawn, are not what books mean to people in general now.
Oh, I don't want to hear that. Because
No.
you have those ones that just stayed with you, like Little Woman. Oh my God, Little Woman. They just, you're so nostalgic. They're so nostalgic and so important, like the thread of your makeup as a writer, I think. Or those books are just so, those class, they're just so important. It's sad. It's sad. That's sad to hear.
This is a long conversation, and maybe you and I can do another podcast and really jump more of this stuff. But Substack started out as this platform for writers, a blog platform, but it's morphing into a social media platform.
It is.
Yeah, it's and it's I'm like I've been in it for 4 years or so,
Oh, I
many.
didn't realize that. I knew you were in the beginning stages then.
And I've watched it like it before my eyes. I'm watching this thing morph. And so it's the same with AI. Like we have, I am not AI. I'm AI neutral. I'm not positive. I'm not negative. I'm not going to blast AI now. But what is happening is we're in this moment where we have zero idea of how AI is going to upturn books. We have no idea.
I have a lot of friends of mine who are writers, are they hate AI. Obviously, they feel like it's, stealing from them. And who knows? I don't know. I'm kind of a more neutral on it too.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you hate AI because
It's here.
It's not going anywhere. And the
Yeah.
smarter way to look at it is to get on there and see what it offers, see why it does the things that it does. You know, ask yourself, does this AI really hate humanity or does it not? You know,
Yeah.
like I think that's the smarter is to go in this into this eyes wide
Instead of quit fighting, because you know it's going to be here and just continue with it. I do want to ask you what I know. We're kind of running out of time, but there's a question that I really wanted to ask you about your activism, because I feel like, well, I mean, obviously you have these personal reflections, but and it's a place-based question, really, because I feel like you are preserving your family history for sure, but you're also preserving place. And so, how does activism fit into that? And this is a big question too. How does activism fit into writing memoir?
Yeah,
Another hour-long discussion.
know, a lot of people, when I was first learning to write, people would say, you know, like, you shouldn't have a mission. Like, you should just, like, a writer is just a writer and it's
Yeah, just
wrong
go with the
to have,
muse. Yeah.
yeah, it's wrong to have an opinion, but it's, but that quickly got tossed on its ear because I am a person, I believe a better world is possible. I believe that the arc of a human life is an arc toward betterment. I think we all want to be better versions of ourselves. If I didn't believe that, it would be very hard for me to just like make it day to day. And because of that deep existential belief that the world can be a better place, most of my work is directed toward that end. Most of my work is activistic.
Oh, yeah.
I try to write it as if you wouldn't ever know. Like when I go out and do a talk, my main goal is to see, is to get people weeping in the auditorium because I know that I've carried them back to some place and touched
Yes.
something really deep inside of them. And when that place is touched, then transformations can happen. Writing is nothing if not a transformative act. And why not use it for human good
Yeah.
toward a more sustainable, more just, more merciful place, a more merciful planet. Yeah.
That's a great answer. Well, we are going to have to wrap it up, but I have not forgotten that you've agreed to read a little bit from Craft and Current. But I want to leave this episode with not my voice yammering on, but with your voice. So if you wouldn't mind, would you please give us a little read?
Yes, I would love to, and thank you for asking me to do that. So, if every human is a character in an important story, and if stories are maps, if they are pipelines to our hearts, if they are the leaves that build the soil of our culture, if they're medicine, boats, rivers, spider webs, mycelium, if they are transformative and the route to empathy, then the job of the writer starts looking very important. Writers begin to look like change makers, like cultural creatives, like thought leaders, like holy people. Do you see what I'm doing here? I'm letting you know that yours is a big job. Your writing is life-giving, even sacred. Devote time to it. Get good at it. Since you are the main character in your story, write a great one.
It was really good seeing you and talking to you, and we will run into each other. I have a feeling we'll see each other this in 2026.
You do so much. You do so much for writers in general, Georgia writers,
You
Southern writers.
too.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Thank you for
Oh
all you do. And thank you for having me on the podcast.
no, I loved it. It was great. Thank you.
All
Have a good
right.
holiday. Bye bye.
All right. See ya.